for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. On December 28, 2009, a bomb exploded on a busy street in Karachi, Pakistan, killing 30 people, wounding hundreds of others. Most of the dead were members of a minority Muslim sect, marking a day of mourning. In his first book, NPR's Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep explores the roots of a day's violence in Pakistan's largest city. Inskeep has been reporting from Pakistan since 2002. He says the forces that shaped Karachi are underway all over the developing world. His book is titled Instant City, and Steve Inskeep joins me in the studio. I know many of you know and enjoy hearing him on NPR's Morning Edition each day. I thought he was going to take a bit of a rest this morning, but no, indeed, I woke to hear Steve Inskeep on the air. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Diane. Well, I had to be there for you. So
I understand.
And it's a great honor to be here now.
Thank you. It's good to have you here. And, of course, we are going to take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. When I first saw the cover of your book and the title, Instant City, I wasn't quite sure what you were getting at, but you're really very specific in this book.
That's my goal, because I'm covering this huge, huge trend that has affected all our lives and that underlies a lot of the news events of recent decades. The way that our economy has changed around the world is reflected in the way that cities have changed. Cities have grown enormously all through the developing world and even in some parts of the developed world. They are showcases for the new economy. They're showcases for the global economy. They're showcases for the kind of economic inequality that you were talking about in the last hour on this program. It's a huge development, and I wanted to get it down to a scale where we could understand it. So I ended up focusing on one city, and then, as you said, Diane, trying to focus on the really dramatic story of one day, thinking that if I could understand that one day, I would understand a lot more about our lives.
Take us back to that one day.
December 28th, 2009 is a holiday in Pakistan. It's a religious holiday known as Ashura. It's celebrated principally, although not entirely, by Shiite Muslims, who are a minority in Pakistan. And as they proceeded through central Karachi, on a street that is named after the founder of Pakistan, the procession was bombed. What happened after that was in some ways even more dramatic and revealing about the city. A number of people appeared on the streets, and there are still to this day differing opinions about who they may have been and no proof about who exactly they were. But people appeared on the streets some distance from this deadly bombing and set a large part of the wholesaling commercial district of the downtown on fire. Hundreds of shops were destroyed, which then led to a huge controversy over what happens to the real estate, because Karachi is a growing city where real estate is constantly more valuable, and endless conversations end up turning around real estate just as they might in an American city or any place else in the world, with the difference being that it is a much more Wild West atmosphere. And so you have all these different conflicts coming together in a single day, religious divisions, ethnic divisions, political divisions, and above all, this competition in a growing city for power, money, and land.
How much time did you actually spend there?
I first went to Karachi in 2002, and I've come and went since then. This book grows out of an NPR series in 2008. In which we took Karachi as an example of growing cities. But I wanted to learn more. There actually was a native of Karachi who, during my research, said to me, I love that series. I listened to all of it, and it was really good, but you only got the news. I want you to get more. And she was right about that. I met her while I was on one of my return trips in 2010. I went back and forth several times. It was after this incident in 2009 that became the central focus of the book. Interviewed everybody I could find. And in between was doing research here. There's amazing resources at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. I was flipping through 60-some-year-old newspapers from Karachi.
Part of the problem with the so-called instant city, and certainly with Karachi, is the lack of electricity.
Yeah.
And the problems that that creates in terms of trying to have a livable surrounding.
Think about that first in concrete terms. If I go to actually anywhere in Pakistan, and I'm covering stories about whatever I'm covering, whether it's urban growth in Karachi, whether it's the death of Osama bin Laden, whether it's other things. You go to someone's home or office, and the light goes out. If it's in the evening, it'll be completely dark. And the striking thing is that you notice, your heart jumps, the power just went out. And the person who's talking to you doesn't even skip a beat. They continue with their sentence.
Phase.
It's normal. It's normal to continue sitting in the dark. But it is a lot more significant than that, of course. It disrupts industries. It disrupts people's lives. It makes it hard to refrigerate food. And it becomes a metaphor for the lack of organization, the lack of governance, and also the shortage of resources in a swiftly growing country. This is a country in the developing world where people have a lot more cars, they have a lot more appliances, they have a lot more TVs, and of course, everything there demands more energy. And so the power shortage, to some degree, is a reflection of economic success, but its persistence year after year after year, where there's blackouts every day, is a symptom of failure.
It's also a symptom of the kind of economic disparity that we see being protested here in this country and around the world. You tell a story about night golf.
Night golf, yes. You can go on a golf course in an area of Karachi that's been developed by the army. And that's a less known fact about Pakistan's military, which has been so much in the news this year, is the fact that in addition to their great political power, they have economic power. They own a lot of land, including waterfront land in Karachi.
How come?
Well, it goes back to, oddly enough, ancient Roman times when soldiers were given land as a kind of retirement payment. And that has passed on to different armies through the world. It is true in Pakistan. But what has become the reality is that people get a bunch of land for below market rates, which they can then sell. And so every retired major can become a real estate developer. And the military writ large also controls a lot of land, which they themselves develop through these housing authorities, including one in Karachi. And so you can go in this city that has millions of poor people, and you can find high-rise apartments on the water that have been built by a firm in Singapore. And you can find a club that is advertised as having six-star facilities. And you can find, in this city that's short of electricity, a golf course where, because it's very hot during the day very often, you can go in the evening and play golf, and the lights will come on like it's a stadium.
And the military owns it.
The military owns it, and they have first call very often on any kind of resources that you want. They live, I don't want to say that they live an easy life. This is a military that's at war, that has suffered thousands of casualties, let's be fair. But it also has first call on a lot of the resources in Pakistan.
So you've walked into some of these instant homes created within instant cities.
Yeah.
No flooring.
Perhaps. There may be dirt. There may be no ceiling. There may be no roof. I met with a couple of Bengali families in 2008 who were among the, and I say Bengali, they were migrants from what is now Bangladesh. In 2008, and they were living in these houses that they had half built. They couldn't afford to finish them, on land that had been seized from somebody else by some developer that we couldn't quite identify and sold to these people on a rather short-term installment plan. They bought the houses. They couldn't afford to finish them. And you just hope to get some roofing up by monsoon season. The rest of the year, it doesn't rain. And so you're living there in what looks like a desert. Nothing is growing. Very little is growing, surrounded by these cinder block walls with nothing. But at the same time, there are illegal homes or unauthorized homes, whatever you want to call them, that are quite pleasant, that are quite nice, in some cases quite huge, in some cases they look like McMansions. And there are all kinds of people living this way. And in fact, these developments, illicit as they are, and fueled by bribes, greased by bribes, have their defenders in that it will be argued that nobody else is really providing for the poor in a city like this. And this is a circumstance where some of the most vulnerable people in society can reach out and try to buy a piece of property, can try to buy a house, provided that they're able to hang on to it.
But what you're also touching on there is the effects of migration.
Yes.
And the fact that you've got people pouring into these cities with no place to live.
And that is what I mean by instant city. This is a type of city that has appeared all over the world, especially since World War II. We're talking about less than the span of a single life, 60-some years since the end of World War II. And you have a city like Karachi that was about 400,000 people and is now, by the most conservative estimate, 13 million. City officials will add several more million onto that. They just haven't been able to prove it yet with a census. It's huge growth. There are at least 30 people there for every one person who was there at the end of World War II. Now, that is on the high end of growth, but it's not the fastest growing city in the world by any means. And there are a lot of other cities that are 10 times bigger or 20 times bigger. There's been tremendous growth. It's fueled by a lot of things. But yes, one of them is migration. And some of that is negative in that people are fleeing catastrophes, whether it was the partition of India in 1947 or the war that is going on in the border with Afghanistan right now. But part of it also is positive migration. People want to get a better education, find a better paying job, have a better life, and you realize that as difficult, as challenging as life is in a city like Karachi, it is better than wherever people came from.
Steve Inskeep, he's co-host of NPR's Morning Edition and author of a new book. It's titled Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Welcome back. Steve Inskeep is with me. You know him as the co-host of NPR's Morning Edition. He's also the author of his first book titled Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. He spent a lot of time reporting from Pakistan, and this is the result of that reporting. Here's an email from Jonathan, who says, while the developing world modernizes its infrastructure, changing mindsets happens at a much slower pace. It seems unfair to expect people who lived under almost feudal circumstances to suddenly become a democratic society as seen in more advanced societies. How is Pakistan's government addressing the gap in modernizing societal norms?
Jonathan, I think you make an excellent point in that culture changes more slowly than building a new building or building a new roadway. And when new technology has come in, it has had to coexist and sometimes clash with those older cultures. And that has been a problem in Pakistan. He used the word, Jonathan used the word, feudal, and that's a word that is used in Pakistan to describe the arrangements in the countryside from which many people come. There are large landowners who were almost like the feudals of old Europe that we think about, who dominated society in every way and dominated the peasants who lived under them and under their protection, but also under their dominance. It's a lot of those poor people who come to a city like Karachi, where they find that a lot of those old elites still have an awful lot of the money and power. And that is a tremendous struggle. The government has had problems with that. It is one of many reasons why it's difficult to have a fully free and fair democracy in Pakistan. One of the things that would improve it, I suppose, would be a better education system. But unfortunately, that is an area where the state has, in many instances and with some exceptions, fallen down. And this is a country where the illiteracy rate is over 40%, which is shocking, and it's a great loss, and it's high compared to even other developing countries. It's a serious problem.
What do you see here in the United States that might compare to Karachi as an instant city?
Well, if we talk about cities that have swiftly grown and changed to the point where people struggle to deal with them, I think of a city like Houston, where a lot of these bumps have been made smoother by the fact that it's a capital of the oil industry. There's a lot of money in Houston, a lot of enterprise, a lot of ingenuity in Houston. But it's an incredible place from which I've also reported, and it's exciting to be there and to look around and to realize that you have a large Anglo community, you have a large Hispanic community, you have a large Asian community, you have a Chinatown, not only in downtown Houston, but in the suburbs that goes as kind of strip mall for miles and miles, a Chinatown with Chinese signs far out into the Houston suburbs. And you also have, incidentally, a South Asian community that's pretty large. Not long ago, they had a Pakistani-American city councilman. So you had all kinds of people coming together and trying to figure out how they coexist in a landscape that is really unfamiliar to them all. Even the longtime residents, the lifelong residents of Houston, are surely living in a city that looks dramatically different than what they remember from when they were young.
You know, it's interesting. You go back in history, the modern history of Pakistan, starting with its leader, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who apparently felt that the more diverse the belief system of the population, the better it was.
This is a strange thing that we should keep in mind as we consider the disturbing news that comes out of Pakistan these days, that upon independence in 1947, even though Pakistan was created to be a homeland, a majority Muslim homeland, and Jinnah was its leader, it was a very diverse place then. It was only about 70% Muslim. The rest were Hindus and some other people of other religions. Jinnah embraced that. He was a member of a minority Muslim sect, the Shiites, the same ones I describe as being bombed in the beginning of Instant City. He gave a dramatic speech just before independence in 1947 in which he told his people, urged his people to live as equal citizens regardless of color, caste, or creed. You read it, you almost get choked up. He says he's just speaking off the cuff. Whether he was or not, it is a dramatic speech. It's one of the founding documents of Pakistan. It remains, even though the vast majority of the Hindus were killed or expelled in 1947 and soon after, it remains a strikingly diverse place. And Karachi, this great instant city, is by far the most diverse place of all. It's taken in migrants from everywhere. There are different kinds of Muslims. There are Christians with institutions that play leading roles in the communities. There are Parsis, who are Zoroastrians, an ancient Persian faith. There are people of other religions as well. It's an incredibly diverse place in so many different ways. And the great challenge of that city, which I explore through this one deadly day, is how does everybody mediate their different interests? How does everybody figure out a way to work together so that everybody feels included and fairly treated? And more than that, how everyone is in fact treated fairly. How do you do that?
How do you do that? Indeed, he perhaps saw his dream realized, but only briefly. He died, a year after Pakistan was created and India took in this whole group, so that then what you have is almost a purification of the entire country.
The phrase ethnic cleansing comes to mind, doesn't it? I mean, that would be one way to describe what happened in 1947. It's a reminder, really, it's a great catastrophic reminder of the dangers of identity politics. Hindus and Muslims had worked together in the movement for independence in British India for decades. Jinnah was a leader, by the way, of working together. But in the end, they drifted apart for a lot of reasons we could get into here, having to do with the difficulty of fighting the British and so forth. But in any case, they ended up being divided into two countries, but you could not divide them cleanly. Because you were going to have Hindus on the wrong side of the line. You were going to have Muslims on the wrong side of the line. You were going to have hundreds of thousands of people, although it wasn't anticipated, who would end up either being attacked or trying to flee to the other side with catastrophic consequences. And when you look at Karachi, you've seen continuing divisions between people. And what you do discover, as you alluded to earlier, is that when the city became less diverse on paper, most of the Hindus were driven away. It became a 90-something percent Muslim city. It actually became less stable rather than more. They lost the resources that the Hindus represented. They lost the intellectual capital that the Hindus represented. Mm. And people who remained found new divisions among themselves. There is never a shortage of a minority to turn against, no matter how homogenous you think you are.
Do you think there are lessons for those of us here in this country?
Oh, I think there are, and I want to tell a very concrete story of a very specific day in a specific place. But as I explored this book, as I wrote this book, I kept thinking of it as a metaphor for other situations and other times, and I kept being reminded of my own country in positive and in negative ways. There are references in the book, as a matter of fact, to Chicago, which has had in history, especially when it was growing very rapidly in the 19th century, its own immigrant neighborhoods, its own migrant neighborhoods, its own ethnic neighborhoods, its own divisions along railroad tracks and streetcar tracks and particular streets and parks. And you could not go beyond your group's enclave or you could face physical danger. Now, Chicago, I would not say, has become as chaotic as Karachi. But nevertheless, there are parallels that you can find there. There are parallels that you can draw in the way that people struggle to work together or fail to work together.
What about the police? What about the authorities and how they deal? Well, you talk about Chicago, you talk about New York, you talk about Karachi.
I'm laughing because I was just thinking that the police actually in Karachi have become very efficient, very businesslike. There are these illegal neighborhoods that we mentioned where people will seize, developers say, will seize a chunk of what appears to be government land or someone else's land and slice it up, subdivide it into thousands of houses. For a while, there was a period where the police would come and arrest the construction crews building houses until they were paid a bribe to let the guys out. But it's become much more orderly and businesslike now. Now there's a standard bribe. Last year, at least, there was a standard bribe of something, it was around 57 U.S. dollars when you converted it from rupees, per home lot. Go to the guy at the nearest police station, pay him the standard bribe per home lot that you were developing, and everything is fine, and it becomes as if it's legal until that guy is transferred, and then you have to go pay his replacement. That to me shows a lot about the way that Pakistan is operating right now, in that you have a government that is corrupt, that is not really functioning, and yet you also have people that are practical and find a way to just deal with it. People go into the police station, they pay their bribe, they go on, they do their business, they build a home.
Steve, how did you manage? Do you speak any of the languages?
I have studied Urdu, especially for this project. And I have in past years studied Arabic, which is relevant in a Muslim country. I can say that I'm literate. I cannot say that I speak very well at all, and my Urdu tutor would attest to that. But I studied all that I could, because the more you learn, the more cultural clues you get. English is also a huge language, of course, in Pakistan. It is the language that people define as the language of the global economy. It's a passkey to the global economy, and so many people know it very fluently, and many other people are striving to speak it. But I want to say one other thing. even if I spoke fluently English, Urdu, and even Arabic, say, I would not be prepared to talk to everybody that I need to in this city. That's another fact about it. There are about half a dozen significant languages because people have come from all over Pakistan, and different languages are predominant in different parts of Pakistan. And you even have migrants who come to that city from some remote village or not so remote village where they speak a local language, a regional dialect, and they don't know any of those major languages.
Steve Inskeep, and his new book, his first, is titled Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And we have some callers waiting. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. First to Indianapolis. Good morning, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Diane.
Morning, sir.
Show.
Thank you.
Hey, I just wanted to say thanks to Mr. Enke for that comment about Chicago. I used to live in Chicago, and that was also true. The neighborhoods are divided by the railroad tracks. We used to call them viaducts, mm-hmm. and you didn't cross over. And I just wanted to say thanks. That's the first time I heard somebody mention that outside of Chicago.
Well, it's continued, Kevin, until the present day, or at relatively recent anyway. In the late 90s, I did some reporting in the Chicago suburbs and discovered that if you followed Interstate 57 in the southwestern suburbs, you would find far more white people on one side and far more minorities on the other side. It wasn't universal, but it was significant. I'd hope that if I go back today, I'd find that is less true, but it was certainly true pretty recently.
Thanks for calling, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, I've just finished David Ignatius' new novel, Blood Money, all about Pakistan, the ISI, the CIA, how they interwove their activities. And I find myself wondering how Pakistanis feel about Americans, about you in particular, and about us in general.
You know, Pakistanis are very frustrated with the U.S. government, but I have found them to be almost universally hospitable and incredibly generous with their time. Even people whose behavior you might find to be awful will be very kind to you. And a lot of people, you find their behavior to be quite heroic. In fact, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to focus on this particularly deadly chain of events that I lay out in the book, this bombing followed by the arson, followed by more bombings that take place over a number of days. You find incredible stories of people who survive those events and who go on and who stand up for values that they believe in, stand up for the values that we talked about in that speech about treating everyone the same. And so that to me was wonderful. And just on an individual level, I mean, I even went to Pakistan immediately after the killing of Osama bin Laden and spent a couple of weeks there. And there were strange jokes that were told, especially in Lahore, where that American Raymond Davis had been arrested and accused of spying, accused of killing a couple of Pakistanis. People would say, oh, you look like Raymond Davis. You look like Raymond Davis. Are you sure? I'm not sure I want to let you in here. You look like Raymond Davis. But by and large, people are incredibly hospitable. In fact, my mom in Carmel, Indiana, has told my brother after reading this book, she said, you know, I wish that I'd been able to read your book before you went over there to report it, because I would have worried about you an awful lot less. You know, it's okay. I mean, people are in Pakistan, I found them to be generous, and they're eager to tell their story to Americans, and they're interested in what Americans think of them.
But do they see, for example, the ISI in the same way we do?
Far more complicated picture. I think that the person on the street is at least as suspicious and resentful of Pakistan's main intelligence agency as Americans are. There's a widespread feeling that the ISI has interfered in domestic politics to the detriment of the country for decades. There's a widespread understanding, it's not really denied by anyone, that the ISI has been involved in supporting or setting up militant groups that have now become, as it's commonly called, they're a Frankenstein monster threatening the future of that country. There's tremendous resentment. At the same time, when Admiral Mike Mullen, just before his retirement from his post as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, made his statement accusing the ISI of directly supporting a militant group that had attacked the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan, there was a somewhat more complicated and different reaction. Some people, a lot of people really in Pakistan, rallied to the cause of the Pakistani army. In the end, it is their country. In the end, there is a degree of pride in the army, despite their resentment about people's resentment about their involvement in politics. And people in that instance seem to stand behind their army.
Stand behind them and yet fear them at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Steve Inskeep, his new book, his first, is titled Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now presenting a retrospective of Willem de Kooning, more at MoMA.org. By John and Catherine Debs, committed to advancing public understanding of America's energy needs and options. And by the Overbrook Foundation, supporting CatalogChoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail. This is NPR.
You think that money is everything?
That's Seth MacFarlane, creator of the animated series Family Guy, American Dad, and The Cleveland Show. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about comedy and we'll listen to his unironic new album, in which he sings relatively obscure music from the American popular songbook. Join us.
A brook would care, or that a rose would say, hey, there goes.
Welcome back. Here's a tweet from MM, who identifies himself as being from Karachi. He said, Mr. Inskeep, what do you think is Karachi's biggest problem and what's the remedy?
The rule of law, or the lack of the rule of law, seems to me like a problem that permeates everything. It's a drag on the economy. It's a drag on society. It makes it more difficult to educate people. I've just finished an item for Foreign Policy that looks at schools in Karachi. People in Karachi are far better educated than outside. And people I've interviewed in Karachi have come to the city for an education. It's so important. And yet there are schools that can go months or even years without even opening. And part of it is because there's violence in the neighborhood, and the teachers are from the wrong ethnic group and can't come there. And part of it, quite frankly, is just corruption. There are teachers who will pay a bribe to get a job where they know they don't really have to show up because no one is going to go and check on them.
Wow.
And you know, I actually write in the book that if I could wish one thing for my friends and my acquaintances there, it would just be a stable, respectable, boring government. They don't need any more excitement there. I mean, maybe it's like an extreme version of how we're feeling here. Maybe we don't need any more excitement in America either. We want stability. And we want things to just the world
operate
to,
the way they're supposed to.
We want the world to stop long enough that we can catch up and make sense of our lives.
All right, let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Mumtaz, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning. This is Mumtaz Lalani from Pakistan, proud American now. Thank you for writing the book and letting the people know what is going on. The biggest problem in Karachi or old Pakistan is too much corruption, like you just touched that point. I mean, government, police officers, our president is also, you know, before he became a president, when he was married to Benazir Bhutto, he was Mr. 20%. That means that he was charging 20% on any business or any licenses to be opened. Now, since he's a president, he's almost 75 and 100%. You know, it's totally, I mean, people are held hostages in their homes when there is no electricity every couple of hours.
Mumtaz, thanks for the comment. Let's be fair to President Asif Ali Zardari by mentioning that he contends that the charges against him were politically manufactured, and certainly any number of politicians have been convicted. But yes, he was called Mr. 10%, and people have speculated that there's been some inflation over time. I think the larger distress with Zardari at this moment that makes him a frustrating figure for Pakistanis is he able to deal with the multiple problems this country is facing all at once? The economic crises, the massive floods, the war going on along the border, the effort to reassert democracy and reassert military control. People are massively frustrated, but they're also, and I was just in Karachi earlier this month and I heard people defend him. In a very specific way.
Interesting.
The very specific way being that Zardari is the head of the Pakistan People's Party, the PPP. And that party won an election at the beginning of 2008. And they're still in power. They haven't been thrown out. They haven't been forced out by anybody. They haven't been forced out by the military. There hasn't been a military coup. And they're getting closer and closer to simply finishing a five-year term and standing for election again and then winning or losing. And that alone would be a huge milestone for this country that has suffered repeated military coups ever since its founding in the 40s.
All right, to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Prentice.
Good morning. I have a very simple question. It's a very complex answer right now.
All right.
Who controls the Pakistani nuclear arsenal?
I'm going to give you the simplest answer that I can. The Pakistani military controls that arsenal. Civilian authorities have, at best, an advisory role. After these elections at the beginning of 2008, there was an effort to take a little firmer control over the military, but that has largely been rebuffed.
How concerned are you about the nuclear weapon control?
I don't operate with a lot of information there. You would like to think that if anything is secured in Pakistan, that the nuclear weapons are secured in Pakistan. But of course, there is the case of A.Q. Khan, the nuclear scientist, who has been implicated in all sorts of trafficking of nuclear information around the world, and it raises concerns. Now, the other concern that is raised about the nuclear weapons is that a radical Islamist government will suddenly take control of Pakistan and be nuclear armed. I would like to think that that is still a remote possibility. There is a vast, vast, even today, even though they're intimidated, even though there's silence, there is a vast pool of moderation in that country. Islamist parties have never done well in national elections. And the army, although according to U.S. intelligence officials, is severely infiltrated by various Islamists, and they've in fact arrested people inside their own ranks from time to time, the army by and large seems like a relatively modern, relatively moderate institution in the ranks. And so there is hope that that kind of takeover of the entire country is really some distance away if it ever happens at
all. Does that answer it, Prentice?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for calling to Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Mohsen.
Hello. It's a pleasure to talk to both of you.
Thank you.
You spoke earlier about military coups happening in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of the last decade, Pakistan, you know, seated in power with General Musharraf, who came to power underneath the military coup.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see your perspective about, you know, his entire regime, which, you know, came through a very difficult decade. And what sort of positive and negative impact do you think the Musharraf regime had upon the culture and environment and political landscape you see in Karachi today?
You know, that's an interesting question. It's Mohsen, right? Interesting question, Mohsen, because Musharraf was a liberal. In the Pakistani sense, meaning that he seemed to be in favor of a freer press. He seemed to be in favor of a freer society and smarter local government, and actually the very existence of local government, he was in favor of that. He was in favor of a lot of modern-sounding reforms. But, of course, the way he was going to impose these reforms was by taking over the country and imposing them. It was liberalism with an iron fist. And a lot of those shortcuts have not worked out in the end. And that is really true of the whole history of this country. You repeatedly have someone who comes in, and he is quite frequently very smart, very charismatic, very impressive to the West, and has a very can-do spirit, and he comes from this military institution, so you figure they're efficient and they can get things done. And in the beginning, they get things done. But as time goes on, there starts to be chaos. And there is a reason that every military dictator in Pakistan, by the end of his time in office, has been widely reviled, because people sense the shortcuts and they sense things getting worse or feeling unequal, even as they get better in some ways. And people have not bought into the system. There's been no consensus behind the reforms that they're attempting to impose. So I wouldn't dismiss everything Pervez Musharraf ever did. The very fact that he freed up the media, that there are like 100 cable TV channels in Pakistan, whereas when I visited in 2002, there was state TV and maybe the BBC if you could get it, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Now there's a huge raucous debate, and you can give Musharraf credit for that reform and a number of others, but the acid tone of the news that you hear on those cable channels is also partly his responsibility. He left some problems behind.
Tell me about the people's attitudes, the ordinary folks that you talk with, their attitudes regarding India.
Oh, gosh. That is a subject of great distress, of great paranoia. Musharraf Zaidi, who's a newspaper columnist and development expert who lives in Islamabad right now, has written a column a few months ago in which he basically compared that relationship to someone who's been through a bitter, bitter divorce and can't stop talking about it. And it is that way. I haven't spent time in India, but anybody who's been in both places remarks on the similarities of culture, the similarities of the people, the similarities of the attitude in simple things like the food or the music, and in deeper cultural things about the way the place works or the way the place doesn't
but
work.
But India seems to have done so much better economically.
You know, it sure does, and a lot of that difference is real, but I want you to keep something in mind when you think about both India and Pakistan. Pakistan, for all its phenomenal trouble, has a lot of India's advantages. India, for all of its advancement, has a lot of Pakistan's disadvantages. There in India also, you have millions and millions of people who are illiterate or barely literate. You have millions of people who see no opportunity to get ahead. You see many of the same problems, which is a bad thing in India, but you see some of the same opportunities in Pakistan that India is now grabbing.
Steve Inskeep, he's host of NPR's Morning Edition. His new book is titled Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now let's go to Richardson, Texas. Good morning, Sharmina. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning, Diane. Good morning, Mr. Inskeep.
Hi.
I just wanted to share, I was born and raised in the States, and growing up in the 80s, we never went to Pakistan because of the political situation. And I went for the first time when I was in college and ended up going to medical school there. So I got to live there for 5 years. And and live the experience, and I really enjoyed myself. But like you said, there is, you know, corruption at every end, and I saw it everywhere, you know, while in college. Even just to get a simple document signed by the principal, you really had to, like, you know, go through, like, 10 people just to get something signed.
Yeah.
You know, it was unbelievable. But my question is, what do you think of right now this whole movement with Imran Khan and the youth? Do you think it's going to go anywhere? Do you think there's possibility that he might be able to move up in the ranks in politics?
Oh, my goodness, Sharmina. Let me explain that for people. Imran Khan is a famous athlete in Pakistan. He's one of the most famous and admired people in the country, but he's become a politician and is the leader or a leader of a party, or the face, the front man of a political party that has tried for a number of years without a lot of success to gain traction in Pakistan. Recently, he has been dealing with Islamist parties. He's been lashing out at the United States. He's been doing a lot of populist-sounding things that have gained him a fair amount of support. In the end, I don't know whether that gets him anywhere or not. I don't know whether he has the party machinery. It's the same as the United States, only far more so. You need the party machinery to get out the vote for you to be a serious player at election time.
What about young people?
Oh, now, young people, there is a lot of frustration and disillusion right now. There are people in Pakistan who have been watching the Arab Spring, the incredible events of this year across the Middle East, and they feel a little sad because they say, we had our revolution, which they did in 2007. They kicked out that dictator, Pervez Musharraf, and it hasn't worked out very well for them. It's been a long, long, incredibly difficult slog. And I think that what I have seen in my conversations with young people most often is a desire to get out, or a desire to at least have the option to get out. Some of the elite students who can come to the United States for college or have a connection in England will be getting that second passport, or will be making sure they have the way to get a visa so that they have the option to get out of the country if things get too bad.
Steve, I can't let you go without asking you about your own career, how you got to NPR and eventually became the co-host of Morning Edition.
Oh, it's very sweet of you to ask, Diane. I'm a guy from Indiana. I started at my high school radio station in Carmel. I worked for a public radio station in Moorhead, Kentucky. I'm a graduate of Moorhead State University, a proud graduate of the Eagles. And so I worked at WMKY, making minimum wage, putting Scott Simon's show on the air Saturday mornings.
I love it.
And doing sportscasts and so forth. And then I fell in love with a girl, and she was connected to New York. And we ended up moving together. We're still married, Carolee and I. And we lived in New York for a while. And I had an opportunity to work for public stations as well as commercial stations there. And I love radio. I love journalism. I love writing. I love everything about the job that I do. I mean, I grew up listening to sportscasters on AM radio, and I love that kind of live radio. And I love reading great journalists, great investigative journalists like Seymour Hersh, or great writers like David Remnick. I mean, brilliant, brilliant people. And I've just been excited to be here. And I feel like I've just kind of lived in a really busy time, especially since 9/11. And I've just been willing to do whatever needed to be done. Somebody said we need someone to host this program on the weekends, and so I did. And I met a colleague after the announcement was made that I was doing a Weekend All Things Considered, and he said, congratulations, your career has advanced to the point where you get to work Saturdays and Sundays. And then my career advanced to the point to where I get to get up in the middle of the night.
Right.
But
right.
I love doing it. Yeah. And it's okay.
What time do you get up?
I get up around 2:40 in the morning. Maybe I hit the snooze alarm. And I'm in at work by about 3:45, give or take a few minutes. And the show goes in the air at 5 a.m.
How does that affect your personal life?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I read to my daughter right before I go to
bed.
How
old is she?
She is 6 years old.
I see.
She's getting to the point where she wants to stay up later than I do. But I still read to her before I go to bed. We've been reading Harry Potter. And then I try to go to bed and get, you know, 7 hours of sleep.
Whoa.
And, you know.
What does that do to the system? to your internal system.
I'll tell you when I'm done with this job. And the reason I say that, Diane, is that I worked an overnight job or an early morning job at WBGO in Newark, New Jersey, a public radio station there. And I didn't realize how much I had been affected by that 4.5 years until I was done with it. And a few months later, I realized how much better I felt all the time. Now, I've tried really hard to take care of myself during these last 7 years on Morning Edition and tried to take breaks. But it's a struggle, especially in the last year. And I'm not complaining at all. It's a great job. And most people have a lot more difficult things to deal with than I do. But it's discipline. You have to discipline yourself as you do in anything in life and make sure you look after yourself as well as your job.
And make sure that you find ways to keep up your relationship with your wife.
That takes some work.
That's tough. When
you can have her on, you can have her on for another hour to discuss.
I'm sure I could. Steve Inskeep, what a pleasure to talk with you.
It's an honor to be here, Diane.
Thank
I love
you.
This show, and I'm just
Thank
really
you.
Honored to be invited to this table.
Thank you. The book is titled Instant City: Life and Death in Karachi. Steve Inskeep has been the guest. Thanks to all of you for listening and calling. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we are on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.